Into sports.
20 yards out, Hurst to shoot. Don't shoot! Oh, what a goal from Fabinho! Wow!
Then get into the all-new OTB Sports app.
I think when he apologises to me, I probably will say hello to him. Yeah, no.
Videos, sports news, live scores, interviews.
If Fabregas is going to come up to me in the street and give me some of the mouth that he would have given me on a football pitch, what would he do? He'd get a slap.
Plus, exclusive content on the OTB Podcast Network. The biggest names in sports, ready when you are. Search OTB Sports on your app store and download it now.
The Off the Ball Podcast Network.
The Football Show on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power. Fake crowd noise? The Emirates never sounded so good. Gamble responsibly. CWE.net.
I'm prepared to anything I can.
Well, do it then.
Come see again.
Do it then.
What about your start to the game?
It wasn't bad, was it?
Why should an honest answer be a mistake?
How can a modern day manager not have a mobile phone?
Why should he?
Now you're welcome back. So Stephen Kenny was talking to the media at large today. It feels like we've been talking about this Slovakia-Ireland Euros playoff semi-final forever. It's obviously been delayed several times over, but suddenly it has come into sharp focus. It is Thursday week, 8th of October in Bratislava. The winners will obviously advance to the playoff final against either Bosnia-Herzegovina or Northern Ireland. That will be on 12th of November. Dan McDonnell of the Irish Independent is with us. Good evening.
Evening, Joe. I was enjoying your feisty exchanges with Richie there.
Bloody hell.
It was almost like the Sky studio, you know, except that, I don't know, you actually really weren't getting on there for a minute. I don't know, it was all very uncomfortable, to be honest, you know, very uncomfortable.
Who was I in the exchange? I couldn't work out.
I don't know, actually, a slightly frazzled Dave Jones, to be honest, maybe. It was more like someone coming at him, you know, but yeah. Anyway,
seeing as you've brought it up, you'll notice I hadn't brought it up. I was trying to.
Sorry,
put the
I don't even want to go.
Half hour behind us. I mean, I really was. If anyone's just tuned in now, everything's fine. We're a happy family. It's all been okay. Go on then, Dan. Your thoughts on last night's moment?
Like it was entertaining. Like I did a piece on Keane not long ago where I sort of made the point that he's always going to be entertaining. People are like. You can say, you can hold the view, as I probably do now, that, like, you know, that Roy Keane's probably, that we went through a phase 10, 15 years ago where everything Roy Keane said was right. You know, when Keane says something, it's gospel, it's correct, he's right. I think over time, I think that aura has faded to the point where actually Roy Keane can be wrong quite a lot, but can be right on maybe very basic things. But as a pundit, he's not necessarily going to give you like that explanation of something that's happened in an analytical way. Oh. But it's going to be very entertaining still. And so, you know, I think I made the point in that piece that I'll still be turning on when I hear, like, when you hear Roy Keane's volume, like you hear Roy Keane on the TV, you kind of instinctively find yourself turning the volume up. Even if you protest too much that you're not interested, I suspect even as much as Richie or someone says it, still probably going to keep an eye on the next thing he says. But what probably has, you know, you speak to people who've maybe sparred with Roy Keane over the years, and they've always actually said, some of them would have made the point, I think Johnny Walters has said this openly and others as well, that actually when you take him on, it's what he doesn't necessarily enjoy all that much, probably enjoys it. And I just thought the dynamic was kind of funny. He was actually wronged. He was misheard by Klopp, who then, and he had this awkward exchange, almost like these Zoom calls that people have been on during the lockdown, where people don't know each other that well are trying to have a Zoom call. It's always just uncomfortable. But actually, you could just see Keane on the shoe on the other foot. I thought that was entertaining. Yeah. That's about as far as it goes. You know, it was more like, you know, there's actually a stronger or a strong character in the room too. Whereas you obviously sense with the other pundits at times, and you've been on the stage with him, he's obviously an all powerful presence when he's there.
Yeah.
And people sort of are intent or hooks about really having a go at him in any shape or form. And Klopp was doing it. So of course it was entertaining.
Massively. Yeah. No, he's a unique figure in real life 3D when you're looking at him, for, you know, for sure. But I mean, he's been in disputes before and we've seen that. But I don't think I've ever seen anybody instigate trouble with Roy Keane. Like, Klopp went looking for it. You know, sometimes you have to defend yourself, or you find yourself in a debate with him if he disagrees what you said. But Klopp was like, hang on a second, I want to start a fight with Roy Keane here. I've never seen that. ever.
And Keane is like, well, actually,
not
I
since
wasn't
Mick McCarthy walked
one.
In with the newspaper. Ah, no, let's not go into that.
But Keane wasn't actually starting one. You see, that was the whole thing. It was like, there was a confluence of events. But hey, I don't think it's worth like analysing to death either. No. It was just a moment, and I think I sort of agree with your point, or was it Richie's point? It's the industry that arises from
that
the Keane stuff that
could
be grating. But actually, I watched it for 5-10 minutes. I was laughing away, going, "That was great." That's it. You know.
Yeah, totally. If we had the discipline to just park it, or else if social media.
What does this
exist,
say about him? Yeah. What does this say about him? Sort of stuff. It doesn't say very much.
We can overreach. Well, I've enjoyed this chat on it more than you screaming at me for the last half hour, or someone else screaming at me. I have to say.
Okay. Well, that's good.
Less anger in this chat.
Let's move on.
Whoo. Okay. So Stephen Kenny in town. I mean, as I said there, this game has almost felt like it was forever just beyond the horizon, and now it's so immediately here, and it's obviously of such importance. He has named his team, Dan. The headline news being, I suppose, it's a 25-man squad. Jack Byrne is in, and Derek Williams is in as well. They were the two who certainly weren't in for the Bulgaria-Finland games. Any other kind of general bits and pieces from the squad named initially you want to mention?
You know, not really, but that in itself is probably informative, that like he basically named a 24-man squad last month. He's lost Troy Parrott. He's changed one of the goalkeepers with Kelleher instead of O'Hara, and he's added Jack Byrne and Derek Williams, and that's basically it. Like, you're at that 20, you know, that's the turnover. So there really isn't, like I said, I'll make this point in the piece I'm doing for tomorrow, that actually it's not really the squad announcements that's the intrigue. It's almost confirming the point that really it's what he does with the existing pool of players that are there, as opposed to necessarily this radical overhaul. Now, in fairness, he has put in Ida and Malumbi, and he's done that, and he's put them in from the start and given them two games in the case of Ida, one in Malumbi. Connolly, obviously, who was around last year, but sort of on the fringes, you know, in and out of the place. But really, I think when Stephen Kenny has a formula that he's broadly happy with, and I think this is a pattern of his career, that he doesn't necessarily like change that much, you know, in the sense that he's not someone who's been a big squad rotation person. You know, he has an idea about the staff he wants and the setup he wants, and probably has had a lot of time to think about the players that he wants. Mm-hmm. And as a result, it doesn't surprise me that, you know, from say game two to game three, if you want to put it in those terms, that we're not seeing all of a sudden, you know, bodies being plucked from left, right and centre. I'm not expecting a big formational change or anything like that. I think it's more a case of trying to produce a better version of what we saw earlier this month, as opposed to, you know, scrubbing the whiteboard again and starting from scratch.
Yeah, good. It'd be a worry if we were at that stage for the third game. First clip for you. So he was asked naturally enough about Jack Byrne's inclusion. Have a listen.
Yeah, I think I've been consistent in my selection. I think, I think we've increased the squad from 23 to 25 with three games this time. I think Jack has played quite well, did well against AC Milan in the Europa League game, it must be said. Thought he did a good game against AC Milan. And obviously followed that up with two goals the weekend. So, he's in the squad on merit. And he deserves to be in the squad.
And him being a home player here, and you're obviously based here as well. Has there been communication between the two of you since the last window, or?
You know, not really. I think I'm in contact with. I spoke to his manager. I spoke to Jack after the last squad and certainly squad announcement. But I've been able to attend some of the games, and that's been it's good to see.
And as a former League of Ireland manager, do you feel under pressure, or did you feel under pressure to include Jack in the squad?
Well, I think you wouldn't know. You wouldn't really know me if you asked that question. You know what I mean? I don't agree with that summation at all.
His eyebrows raised when he was out of the last squad. So
yeah, no, that's irrelevant. I don't. You know, I'm not influenced by anyone else in that regard.
You make your own
decisions. Yeah, you know, I think myself and the coach and staff, we get together and we make decisions based on what we see, and you know, and that's it.
A little bit, you know. Peisty?
Well, yeah, I wasn't in that section now. I was in another section, the way things are done with sort of COVID and smaller pods. But I mean, I do think like it's we've all asked daft questions in our time. But, you know, I think he has to cope with aspects of this, like, you know, like that he picks a League of Ireland player. Oh, do you feel under pressure to do it because of your background? Yeah, maybe it's a fair enough question to ask.
I think it's a fair question.
I think, yeah, maybe so. But, like, I think, I guess his answer is fair as well, that if you knew him, you wouldn't ask that. I don't think that's ever going to be his mindset as Ireland manager and won't be, you yes. know.
Not all of us can know him personally.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I get enough. That. But, like, I think, again, it's just, you know, it's he's just been pigeonholed in this League sure. of Ireland man mode, and I can see how that would grate, to be honest. He's there as Ireland manager on merit too, and to suggest that he would, as a Ireland manager for a big game, but, you know, pick someone from a squad on the basis of some perceived loyalty to something, then he wouldn't be doing his job right. So I think he's entitled to actually hit back at that line of thought a bit, to be honest.
In much the same way that Roy Keane is allowed to express an opinion about Liverpool and Klopp is allowed hit back, we've just seen it there. I'll find a way to weave Roy Keane and Klopp into every exchange this evening. How about that? So Coleman Doherty, a.k.a. Klopp and Keane. Seamus Coleman's obviously been in very good form. Doherty settling in at Spurs, and obviously he hasn't had as much of a pre-season. So Stephen Kenny Dan here asked if that gives him a bit of a headache when deciding the team.
No, listen, these are good problems to have. These are the problems that we want to exist. You know, we don't have that situation in every position, but we are pleased that several players are playing regularly in the first team. I think this is a lot different than a month ago when obviously the players were not. They were in pre-season mode, hadn't played games. And Shame's been in fine form, there's no doubt. And that's a good sign.
Are you tempted to include both now, considering the form of Stephen? And we know Matt Doherty has been solid for so long. Are you in a position now where you just need to include both in your starting 11?
No, we're not in a position to do any. We do, you know, we'll do what we feel is right for the game itself, and I think that's the key. You know, they're both versatile players, so they're both, you know, Matt Doherty and James Coleman are huge assets to Ireland. Like, I think, you know, that's, you know, that's what we want. We want that in all positions if we can have that.
The debate has already started. I'm sure you know. Are you in a delicate situation because if you starts Doherty, people will say, well, Coleman is the former player, whereas if you start Coleman, people will say, well, he's being indecisive, he's chopping and changing.
You know, what anyone else thinks is irrelevant, that's the way I view it, you know, and I think, you know, Seamus has been a great captain for Ireland and great player, and obviously he started the season well. Matt finished the season brilliantly with Wolves, you know, brilliantly, scored quite a number of goals, involving goals every week, creating a, you know, obviously, The last games for us, he was in pre-season mode. He's coming back in a bit, and I thought his best game probably for Tottenham was last weekend. Actually, he looked really back to himself and did very well. So that bodes well.
Not an easy decision.
No, like, I mean, I suppose in some respects you call it a great problem, but it's at the same time it's one that, you know, if the game is won or lost, I think the decision will be judged on the basis of that, if you get me, you know, and it'll be flagged as a factor if it goes wrong, even if it's not the factor that decides the outcome. I think, you know, there's no doubt, like, from speaking even to people who would have, you know, Matt Doherty quite well, he was nowhere near fit enough really last month. So as a result, like, he had an audition of sorts, but probably, like, not a full service audition. But the fact that Kenny picked him would suggest he's going to pick him again. That would be my read from it. Although, you know, I wouldn't, at the same time, like, Coleman has played well for Everton. And it's an interesting one, this, because there was a big clamour, I suppose, for Doherty to replace Coleman, probably across the last 18 months. And now all of a sudden it's coming round to the view where Coleman can't be dropped, whereas there was definitely a groundswell of popular opinion probably going the other way. So it's like Coleman's return to form, it's sort of flipped maybe sides of the debate that people would have taken. It's a challenging one. Again, like, it's possible at some stage he might look at a shape or a structure for a particular game where he looks at playing the boat with him. But I can't see how he does that based on Anthony said in the short term. I think he will have to pick one. And it's tough, yeah. It's a really challenging one. But I think it would be unusual, I guess, for him to have picked Doherty for the two games and then and reverse it. But it's that. I mean, you've got your captain. Like it's not easy. It's not easy. It's the one position where maybe an injury wouldn't cause that many sleepless nights. Although that's maybe a stupid way of talking, really, because they're great quality options to have in any scenario. And I mean, there's three games coming up, and they're all important in their own way. But there's really one game that this window is about.
Yes.
And will he go for the experience? The more experienced heads for that one. Like it's possible in other positions, but I would have thought picking Doherty there, he's got an idea about how the team wants to operate and he's part of it.
We'll pick this up. You're back on the Football Show at 9:30. There's a bunch of other aspects of this I want to talk to you about, and I have a few more clips of Stephen Kenny. It is worth just noting, you know, in the context of just how important this game is. Like, you're watching the Premier League of late, and so Coleman's back in very good form. Doherty's obviously going to get his fitness again. You've got Jeff Hendrick playing at Newcastle, which is a big change for him and can only bring him on. Callum Robinson's two goals against Chelsea, really, really good. You know, took them really well, and he's bound to benefit from a full season behind him in the Premier League. Aaron Connolly, goal last week and a nuisance against United. Conor Hourihan scoring for Villa last night. It's kind of a plethora suddenly doing very well in the Premier League, which is not something we've had for a lot of the last decade.
No, it's a really good start. I think like the stats last year, like I do at the end of every Premier League year, like you do a review of the year or whatever. The stats last year were better than, say, the previous 3 years. And the start of this season already, the appearances in the first two weekends was not far off the total number of players, like individual players that had featured last year. I think we had 16 or 17 maybe involved with the opening weekend, thereabouts. So yeah, look, it is. It is encouraging. Now, again, it's clustered around certain positions. But then there's a you know, and maybe we'll talk about it a bit later on. Mm. Like the Callum Robinson is playing centrally for his club, Aaron Connolly centrally for his club. Maybe different things being asked of them for Ireland. And you know, some of the players that are doing well, like you have to be conscious that they don't necessarily, they're also surrounded by a certain type of players at club level, and fusing them all together with Ireland, like we're still maybe lacking one or two particular type of players, like that real midfield sort of playmaker, say, who creates those opportunities for them. But you know, yes, like there have been times in recent memory where we've looked at weekends with four or five Irish appearances in the Premier League, or none on a Saturday or something. Where you know that situation doesn't look like existing in the season that's ahead. That's for sure.
Yeah, no, it's very positive. Let's pick this up then at 9:30. There's still plenty to talk about. From me, Roy Keane, to you, Jurgen Klopp, Dan. We'll park it there for the moment. Thanks a million.
I look forward to it, Joe.
They scored three goals again tonight. You know, three goals at home, it's never easy to score goals. The last home game, as much as they were stopped against Leeds, scored four. They just got loads of goals in them. But they were sloppy one or two occasions at the back. But job done, and good start to the season for them.
Did I hear it right there? Mr. Keane said we had a sloppy performance tonight? No, because I could hear you already. Did he say that?
Well, I think he said there were some aspects that were. Roy, would you like to say?
No, I think they gave up one or two opportunities, which they'll be disappointed with.
This was a sloppy performance tonight. I just want to only hear it, because I'm not sure if I heard it right. Maybe he spoke about another game. It cannot be this game. Sorry. That's an incredible description of this game. This was absolutely exceptional. Nothing was sloppy. Absolutely nothing. It was from the first second dominant against a team in form, 100% in form. And you have to be careful like hell that not the counterattacks, like I think 60, 70% of all the balls in behind were offside. You wait a little longer for the flag meanwhile. So that's why it feels not great, but it was offside. So then Ali had to make one save. They had two balls in behind. You cannot avoid that. You need a goal in these situations. Apart from that, the football we played was absolutely exceptional tonight. So that doesn't help for any other game, not for Thursday, not for Sunday, for nothing. But about this game tonight, there's nothing bad to say.
Sensitive, these managers.
Very sensitive, isn't it? Jesus, imagine if he'd lost.
Roy, would you expect Liverpool to defend their title?
Yeah. I'll have to say that now after Klopp had a goal, me. I'm afraid to say anything.
Let's hope
my night.
Let's hope he hears that.
Well then, busy football show on the way. Dan McDonald along later on. Stephen Kenny named the 25-man squad for the Slovakia game. We'll talk to Dan around 9:30 or so. But first, seeing as Spurs are losing, shockingly, let's bring in Tim Vickery. Hello.
Hello, Joe Malloy. I have a splendid vision of the side of your head. Now, I'm sure people would pay good money for that.
Yes, I know. There's various cameras going on. Sometimes they catch me unawares with that one. So you're seeing me there.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I got a side profile there of the kind of aquiline nose of Joe Malloy. How the devil are you?
Well, listen, Jose apologised. He said he would love to try in the Carabao Cup, but he can't.
Yeah, I mean, this football in the age of coronavirus is not easy, is there? I mean, the fixture pile-up is plainly absurd. You play Sunday in the Premier League, you play Tuesday in the Carabao Cup, you play Thursday in the Europa League. Someone is going to pay a price for this. You know, you're trying to... The normal calendar in international football is an attempt to fit 3 litres into a bottle that only holds two. And these are not normal times. Something has to give, and I fear it'll be the players.
Yes, I suspect you're right. A few things we wanted to talk to you about. You're writing on ESPN about football in Brazil and across South America and how it's trying to exist alongside COVID. Just in broad terms, first of all, Tim, how are things going in Brazil? The last time we spoke to you, it was looking ominous in many ways. I checked just before coming on air. I think Brazil is third behind the USA and India on the death list, which is not a list you want to be high on.
No, 142,000. We're over that now and heading towards 150,000. The death toll may be falling slightly, but it's going from disastrous to catastrophic or the other way around. So the news is not good. I remind everyone that on March the 22nd, Brazil's president Jair Bolsonaro affirmed that the death toll in Brazil would not exceed 800. It is now over 142,000. And that doesn't seem to have brought about any change of policy.
Oh, really? He hasn't come out and said, OK, we're going to change things up.
Well, one of the problems of the system is it's difficult to hold presidents to account. There's no equivalent of Prime Minister's question time when the opposition can put difficult questions to him. It's up to him if he wants to listen to the media or not. But if there were a kind of Prime Minister's question time equivalent, that should be a question that's being made every week. You know, on March the 22nd, you said the death toll would not exceed 800. Where have we gone wrong and what are you going to do about it? Mm.
Are people wearing masks as they walk down the streets of Rio?
Yes, by and large, yes. Worrying scenes every warm weekend because the beaches are then absolutely packed. And unfortunately, the whole thing has just become normalised. You know, and for the poor neighbourhoods where COVID is especially dangerous, you know, because people live in such proximity, life is so cheap in those neighbourhoods that the thing can almost kind of be brushed off. You know, the threat of dying from COVID is much more remote than the threat of meeting a violent death in areas of Brazil that have the casualty toll of a war zone. So that's maybe one reason that this death toll figure, which looks extraordinarily high, is being treated with apparent normality by huge swathes of the population.
So you were writing recently about football trying to get back on track. The Flamengo-Palmeiras game is a perfect example of the predicament upcoming.
Yeah, there are a few examples. And this is the continent that brought us love in the time of cholera. That's much less complicated than football in the time of corona. You know, love in the time of cholera only needs two people in four walls. Football in the time of corona needs 22 plus substitutes and officials and so on. What are the regulations there to do? Are they there to protect health or are they there to protect the running of the competition? Now, we had a game in Uruguay this Sunday that didn't go ahead because one player tested positive. So everyone had to isolate. We had a game in Chile this Sunday that didn't go ahead because one director who'd been travelling with the players tested positive. In those cases, you can clearly see that the main thrust of the regulations was to protect health. With some other competitions, this is not the case. The Brazilian Championship is one of them. Flamengo came back from a trip to Ecuador, where they played two games in South America's Champions League, the Copa Libertadores, and they came back with a mass outbreak. From that delegation, around 30 tested positive. In total, it went up to 20 players, I believe, the coach, some of the coaching staff, and some of the directors. Now, they wanted their game on Sunday, away to Palmeiras, they wanted that game to be called off. It is the crunch game. Flamengo are reigning champions. Palmeiras, their leading domestic rivals, are champions of the year before. So it's an absolutely crunch game. Flamengo wanted it to be called off. The regulations are absolutely adamant The show must go on. Other clubs have played and will be playing games when a number of players have tested positive. So Flamengo, when they went either to the Brazilian FA or to the sports justice system, their efforts to get this game suspended were denied. Eventually, going through the Rio Players Union, they managed to get a judge in a labour court in Rio to suspend the game. Mm. But anyone au fait with the way things happen in Brazil knows that this is not definitive. This is just one round in a long legal battle. And Flamengo realised this because they travelled to the game and went to the stadium. Everyone is waiting for the suspension of the game to be suspended. And in the end, that's what happened. With 18 minutes to go to the scheduled kickoff, Flamengo's game was back on. And Palmeiras, who wanted to play the game, whose players said they wanted to play the game because they're deriving a sporting benefit. They're up against a team of many rookies there. The average age of the Flamengo team were 21. Well, it didn't work out for Palmeiras because the game was a 1-1 draw. But anything that happened on the field was not nearly as tense and dramatic as all the legal machinations going on behind the scenes.
Wow, extraordinary. I mean, 20. I can understand if people think one director in that Chile situation is excessive, you know, or one player maybe is excessive. We saw, you know, West Ham continued when David Moyes and some players tested positive and things seemed to be okay. But 20, I mean, you would just think common sense kicks in and everyone goes, oh, okay, well, we'll postpone this. Why the pressure? Are they under massive scheduling pressure, or are they taking their lead from Bolsonaro? It's the schedule.
It's scheduling pressure, really. It's if this game doesn't go ahead, then other clubs will do the same and the whole thing will ground to a halt, and we need that income. So the pressures are financial, I think, more than anything else. And a few days earlier, by coincidence, all roads seem to lead to Flamengo at the moment. They played on the previous Tuesday in the Libertadores, the Champions League. This was in the city of Guayaquil in Barcelona, against Barcelona. And the epidemic was already evidence that the full total of people had yet to test positive, but a number had. And Guayaquil is a city traumatized by coronavirus, because a few months ago that was in serious, serious problems. They worked very hard to try and get on top of it. The local health authorities in Guayaquil didn't want the game to go ahead. So they got in touch with CONMEBOL, which is South America's UEFA. It's the administrators of the tournament. And they said, look, we don't want this game to go ahead. They didn't get any joy from that. So the way they found to stop the game going on was to suspend the stadium. The stadium cannot stage games. But at this point, the political levers all start getting pushed all over the place, because, again, there's a desire for the tournament, the games to go ahead, whatever. For this reason, squads have been increased from 30 to 50, exactly to give clubs cover in case there is a mass outbreak of coronavirus. So although the local health authorities in Guayaquil didn't want the game to go ahead, they were overruled by the national health authorities of Ecuador, obviously with pressure from the football authorities being brought to bear. So Flamengo, while they're in Ecuador, they played two games. The first opponent has subsequently detected an outbreak of coronavirus in their ranks. The numbers keep going up. I think it's 8 at last count. They are due in Rio tomorrow to play Flamengo, but this is now two teams who are suffering from coronavirus. But the game will go on, because that's what the regulations are there for, to ensure that the game goes ahead.
This is it's starting to sound unsustainable. The virus is going to catch up here.
Well, it does seem that way. And next week, this goes global, because next week is scheduled to be the kickoff for South America's World Cup qualifiers. Now, the players who represent the South American teams will gather from all across the globe. So it's hard enough just getting them there safely. At least in South America, there are health protocols which really cover from the cradle to the grave, you know, from the start of the team's journey to a visiting country all the way back. Now you're trying to gather the players from all across Europe and Asia and North America. And I wonder if we're going to have problems here. There's a number of players who are based in the United States, and Major League Soccer is saying that it doesn't want to release its players for World Cup qualifiers in South America. That North American region, CONCACAF, North Central America and the Caribbean, because of the coronavirus, they've scrapped their World Cup qualifiers this month and next month, and they won't get underway until next March. South America hasn't gone down the same road. So the MLS clubs, or the MLS itself, which owns the players, the MLS is saying that it's reluctant to release players. And I wonder if this will embolden the European clubs to also play hard in terms of releasing their players. Because from these numbers that I'm giving you, people testing positive all over the place, there is clearly a health risk. There is clearly the possibility that a club will release its expensive player for international duty in South America. And when he comes back, and remember, they're double headers. You're playing one game at home and one game away. So you're traveling within South America. You're leaving your own training complex in your home ground, and you're going to hotels abroad where it seems clear that it's harder to enforce all of the protocols. There is a real danger that players will return back to their clubs having being contaminated with coronavirus. So I suspect we're in for a tense few days of negotiations behind the scenes.
Yeah, I would think so. I in the midst of everything, I haven't even looked. I'm not quite sure where the World Cup qualifiers are at in terms of, are they just getting started? Is anybody in crisis? Is there anything particularly interesting going on with them?
Well, they haven't started yet. They were supposed to start in March. We couldn't do that. And then because of the coronavirus, there were no FIFA dates involving South American teams in September.
Okay.
This is the problem. It's a marathon format. It's 18 rounds, all 10 sides meeting each other home and away. And if we can't play this year, say October and November, you wonder how can they squeeze everything in before the World Cup? They'll have to go to a shorter format with fewer games. And all of the countries involved, with the exception of Uruguay, have already sold the TV rights to a full plethora of 9 home games. Now, there's one way that they could do it. That's to scrap the Copa America, which is due to take place. It was going to be taking place this year. Instead, it's been moved to June and July next year. It's an unwieldy tournament held in both Argentina and Colombia, two countries at opposite ends of a large continent. There are a lot of games there. The easiest way for them to fit everything in would to be scrap the Copa America and use that time in order to catch up on a backlog of World Cup qualifiers. But again, TV rights have all been sold. So South American football is engaged in this battle to try and get everything to fit in. And that's difficult enough when times are good. When you lose 6 months from the international calendar, then that really becomes a problem.
What's the story with fans at stadiums?
Again, all roads lead to Flamengo. At the moment in South America, there are no fans in stadiums. Brazil's health ministry has authorized a return of fans in stadiums to 20% of stadium capacity based on the consent of the local authorities. Now, remember, with Brazil's health ministry, this is the health ministry of the Bolsonaro government. One health minister was sacked because he favoured social distancing. Another resigned for similar reasons. And the one in charge now is a military man with no previous health experience. So what they say should perhaps be taken with a pinch of salt. And we're going to problems here because Flamengo, here in Rio, they would like to play with fans in a stadium. That would be 20,000 people in the Maracanã stadium. Now, their view is that if the health authorities give them the go-ahead to do it, then it can be done. The problem is that other clubs in other parts of the country, the health authorities would be very, very unlikely to give them the go-ahead to put fans in stadiums for a very obvious reason. We're in the middle of a pandemic. Mm. It's clearly not safe to do so. So there was a meeting last Saturday where 19 of the 21st division clubs gathered and they voted 19-0 not to have fans in the stadium. Flamengo didn't send a representative to this virtual meeting because Flamengo's position, as I understand it, is that it's not for other clubs to decide whether or not they can have fans inside the stadium. It's for the health authorities. This has real potential to bring the championship screaming to a halt, even though everyone wants it to go ahead because they need that revenue. Because if Flamengo can have fans in the stadiums and other clubs can't, then that really is a recipe for disaster. So there's a common sense is at a minimum in Brazil at the moment, and the desperation to push ahead with games or with fans in the stadium, that seems to be at a maximum.
Mm. And just how precarious is the financial situation?
Well, football in South America lives close to the edge, even in the best of times. these are not the best of times. So there are clearly huge financial pressures, and some club directors have worried about the industry, even at the elite level, going bust with a prolonged lack of revenue. The TV revenue is coming in. Sponsorship revenue is coming in. So the big loser at the moment is revenue from the box office, which is not as great in Brazil as it could be. The average crowds here are not as high as they should be. They've been lagging behind Major League Soccer in the United States for a few years. But in the current situation, any source of revenue is a valued source of revenue. Yeah. I would hope that we're closer to the end now than we are to the beginning, with vaccines beginning to appear and so on. But it still looks like a long, hard few months ahead of us in South American football.
Yeah, I would presume so. Hey, before you go, Toffee Fan Tony has texted in. What's your thoughts on James? He's doing very well.
Absolutely delighted. Well. And before the 2014 World Cup, I watched Colombia in qualifying, and I was telling all and sundry, this is the man. This is the man. And so when he exploded in that World Cup, I was walking around like I was Pretty Boy Floyd. Someone at the time, I think it was the former Liverpool midfielder, Ray Houghton, said, he's not quite quick enough for the elite status. And I think that was proved right at Real Madrid. And Real Madrid, despite the fact that he had a good first season, they certainly couldn't use him in the front three. But that player who lit up the 2014 World Cup was still there. And he was still there for Colombia, watching him for Colombia. And the one game that he was fit enough to play in the World Cup, it was one of the best performances of the tournament when Colombia beat Poland 3-0. Unfortunately, he wasn't fit for other games. But the player is still there, and he's got so many virtues, and he's got everything on a plate for him now. He's got a coach in Ancelotti who knows him, has worked with him before, admires him, knows what he can do. Yeah. And you just look at the way that the team's set up. Alan, Brazilian midfielder, is a perfect foil for him. An unglamorous player, but a problem solver. Richarlison is a very front-to-goal striker who's a wonderful recipient for the diagonal passes of James Rodriguez. So it's wonderful to see him back and enjoying his football, because none of us gained anything from him kicking his heels at Real Madrid. I'm delighted to see it working. Obviously, opponents will be paying more attention to him now, how to stop him. But he is versatile. And as long as you don't push him right up front, where he does struggle for lack of pace, as long as he can find space to wander into, I think that left foot is such a great magic wand that he'll always come up with something special, even if he's out of the game for 10 or 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. He thrives, I think, on being the go-to player, a status he could never achieve at Real Madrid. And in a way, Everton are a little bit like Colombia. They're not quite in the top echelon, but they've got potential to get in there. Mm. So I think everything is perfect for him, and I've been enjoying his performances almost as much as Everton fans.
Mm. Thrives on being the main player. What kind of personality is he, do you know?
Well, I've never spoken to him, so these things, they always come across as a little bit secondhand.
Sure.
But I do think, and with Colombia, it's been clear that he loves being that go-to player. I think he shrunk a little bit at Real Madrid when he couldn't win that status, when he didn't have quite enough, when it was obviously Cristiano Ronaldo was the king of the hill when he first went there. So I think he's thriving on being important. But I also think, again, looking at him through the way he expresses his personality on the field, I think he's a giver. I think he wants to give to the cause. So, just 2-3 weeks ago, some people seem to be suggesting this was money down a rat hole. It already looks like a masterstroke for Everton.
Yeah, certainly does. Listen, as ever, real pleasure. Tim Vickery, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power. More confident than United before a Europa League final. Gamble responsibly. See dunleavy.net.
When you walk through a storm, hold your head up high. Yesterday, and don't be afraid of the dark. So
as Liverpool come out, they know that the light is beckoning at the end of the tunnel.
Such agony here 11 months ago when Arsenal took the title from them with virtually the last kick of that season. Lesser club than Liverpool would have taken years from that, but here failure only stimulates more urgent searches for success. Kenny Dalglish's third championship in only manager. For the 18th time, Liverpool are the champions.
At the end of a storm, there's a golden sky with the sweet silver song of the Lord.
For me, one of the biggest clubs in the world, and gave me this opportunity to, yes, try to help in a situation that's not so difficult like all the people in this room feel, I think. It's not the perfect moment, of course, but I feel it's a good moment to come here, and so I feel really proud.
A couple of people who can tell you, yeah, but you didn't win. So I know. Let's talk about six, baby. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that may be. Let's talk about six.
First and foremost, I have to say congratulations to City. I said it a couple of times, but I don't want that any broadcaster miss that, because that's important. They played an incredible season. We did as well, but you won it, and that's congratulations. To Pep and all the people from Manchester City.
Liverpool had the greatest season in their entire life, and they still came second. It's too funny.
To Sadio Mane, who makes it 3-0. What a ball from Jordan Henderson in behind the Manchester City defence, and a diving header from Sadio Mane surely seals all 3 points, and a huge victory for Liverpool. It's Liverpool 3, Manchester City 0, Sadio Mane. Oh, Salah to Salah for Liverpool. Salah scores in front of the cup. And Liverpool are going 16 points clear at the top of the Premier League table. And Alisson runs the length of the pitch to celebrate. It's 2-0 at Anfield. And it's never heard noise like it. Mo Salah wins the game for Liverpool.
Walk on through the wind. Walk on through the rain, though your dreams be tossed and torn. Walk on, with hope in your heart, and you'll never walk alone. You'll never walk alone.
Jesus, Childsy, stop. I was in tears. Dan McDonald, Irish Independent, hello.
I actually hadn't heard that before. That was Giles at the end, was it?
Sure was. Yeah, it's lovely. It was
powerful stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, good. That was God. What are we going to talk about to follow that? You know, let's talk about football.
I know. Well, Spurs have just conceded. Sorry, equalised. What am I saying? It's getting late. Spurs have just equalised against Chelsea. Eric Lamela on 83 minutes. So Timo Werner scored the opener for Chelsea. And Eric Lamela has made it 1-1 in the Carabao Cup. Daniel McDonald of the Irish Independent with us. Podcast listeners, as you know, we were speaking to Dan earlier on. Stephen Kenny in town. Well, he's always in town, I suppose. He's of this island. And he was naming his 25-man squad for the Slovakia game, which is now very much in focus, 8th of October. So Thursday week in Bratislava. The winners obviously play the winners of Bosnia-Herzegovina or Northern Ireland on the 12th of November. And the games are coming thick and fast. So before we have to worry about the 12th of November, and hopefully eventually we do, but after this game against Slovakia, then it's Nations League again very quickly. Ireland host Wales on the 11th of October, and then they travel to face Finland 3 days after that. So he had plenty of time kicking his heels, Dan. The games are coming thick and fast now.
They really are. I mean, it's really strange. Like, I mean, this is an international triple header, which in itself is a first, with the exception of, say, in the summer, you know, when you have sort of a spate of games. Mm. This is new. And yet, of course, still with no fans going or planning trips around it, then there's a weird element of detachment from it as well, I think, in a strange way. But in pure terms of what it means to the manager, a new manager and the protagonist, I mean, this is huge. I mean, this is probably, you know, the outcome of the Slovakia game would probably shape how his first year or first section is remembered. I mean, the hope is that it leads to another game, of course, and then that provides that moment. But it's you are right. Like, it does feel like we were talking forever about the Slovakia game, which at various times was being played in March, June, September, October, November, or not at all. And now it's very much happening, even though it appears that Slovakia in general is shutting down big time in terms of their cases. But it does seem there's a determination for this game to go ahead, even if a lot of other sporting activity in that country seems to be under threat. So, yeah, it's a strange old backdrop. I mean, Ireland have had their squad today announced. Slovakia also announced theirs. And, like, one of the big stories was, you know, would Marek Hamzik be able to come from China? They have a couple of players in the in America as well who weren't available last month when their results were bad, with COVID being a factor, or you know, this travel world that we live in. But it does appear that this game will, it's so close, it can't now not happen.
Just to bring you the extra two clips that we didn't get time for earlier of Stephen Kenny speaking today. So one of the points that was put to him was it's just a 25-man squad. Again, a bit like his previous squad, considerably smaller than we've seen in previous regimes. And, you know, given the finances of the FAI, Kenny was asked if that has anything to do with budgetary constraints or if that smaller squad, that 25-man squad, is just very much his preference.
The way I view it is that, you know, I think I like to do 11v11 in training. You know, I like to do 11v11. I don't think you should come on international duty and be a substitute in training. You know, I know some other people in the past, maybe some people maybe played 12v13 or maybe just organised training without 11v11, so just to fit the numbers. So the numbers dictate the training rather than the training dictating how you're exactly going to play. So I don't think we need, you know, I don't think you should come on international duty and be a substitute in training. And I think that's, number one, you can't train properly because you're in and out of the training session. Number two, you're making allowances for provisions for substituting players in and out. And I don't think you can train properly that way. So I think you know, how many players do you need? You don't need 28 or 32. To be honest, 23 is 20 players is fine and 3 goalkeepers, but we need to add to that because of the 3 games and the provisions and the COVID responsibility and the getting players in and out won't be easy because of that. So I think 25 is a reasonable number for the 3 games, but I don't necessarily want that to exceed, or I'm not certainly not budgetary constraints. I don't think there's a need for more players, but it will be taxing on the players. I think there's no doubt it will be taxing. It's they've never had that in a window before. 3 competitive games, 2 away games, and of course being in the bubble, and all that entails. Normally players are able to see their families, and you know, interact with people, but that's not possible, and that's all part of the sacrifice at the moment. But that's you know, that's something that we just have to manage and look forward to that.
Yeah, that all makes perfect sense, that squad size. On Slovakia, Dan, I don't know how much you've seen of them. So they currently sit one ranking spot ahead of Ireland. They finished a point behind Wales in their qualifying group. Here are, first of all, Stephen Kenny's thoughts on Slovakia.
You know, I think it's a tough game. I think Slovakia were, you know, were very unfortunate not to qualify themselves. You know, they played very well. The games against Wales, home and away, and Hungary, home and away, are very interesting for me. You know, very interesting. I don't think their Nations League games bear any relevance. They had 8 changes in the last game against Israel, so they don't bear any relevance whatsoever. I think the games against Wales and Hungary are more, you know, are measuring points really for us to see their strengths. And they had a lot of possession in all of those games. So they're a good team. From our point of view, as a nation, we've not won an away game against a significant nation, you know, in away from home in quite a few years. So it's something that we have to do, something extraordinary now to get a result and rally around each other to get a big performance in Slovakia and try and get that victory. It will be tough. Slovakia being at home, you know, know will be favourites, but I think from our point of view, we believe. I think the great thing about the last window, we were able to have a look at increasing our options in midfield, and in the forward areas. We've seen what worked and what didn't. We have a clear idea what we want in the game against Slovakia. And, you know, so we'll be ready.
So that is Stephen Kenny this afternoon. What is the last big away win? Is it Cardiff, James McLean?
Yeah, I was just thinking, yeah, that is it, the one. And then the Austria game, also James McLean, which is end of 2016. I suppose prior to that, it was a big discussion point going back to Scotland in the 80s, depending on your definition of like a significant football nation. The way Stephen Kenny was almost talking, I think I felt like he wasn't talking about 3 years ago or 4 years ago, but I think those games definitely count, to be fair, Austria and Wales. But how good are Slovakia? Yeah, I mean, I did watch a bit of the game against the Czech Republic last month, but I'll be honest, I didn't turn it off before the end because it wasn't real Slovakia. And actually, I flicked over that night and watched the end of Bosnia against Italy, and they were pretty good. But Slovakia, and I mean, you know, Bosnia or Northern Ireland await the winners. But the Slovakia were so understrength for that game, you can't read anything into it at all. Whereas last year against Wales, even, you know, they fell short against Wales. But look, Wales, we've seen Wales play. We probably would consider Wales to be a reasonably good possession side, and yet Slovakia were dominating possession against Wales in both games. Now, of course, possession, again, there's good possession, there's just possession for the sake of it, so we can get bogged down in possession talk. But they certainly, that maybe shines a light on the type of team they are when their first choice midfield are available, their midfield three. So, you know, they have, you know, they have Hamzik, who's the star name, is in China. There's a Lobotka, who's there, who's in Napoli, was previously at Celta Vigo. And there's a Kuka, another player who was now at Parma in Italy as well. So a lot of Slovakian players. They have two defenders, Serie A as well, that the Slovakian players, a lot of them seem to gravitate towards Italy in their career very naturally.
Hmm. So the rankings then, probably about right. We're relatively evenly matched. This is going to be touch and go, and
yeah,
one of those tricky games and hard to call.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it makes sense that it would be evenly matched given it's through the Nations League route. So the two teams were in the same league in the Nations League, and they both finished third in their groups. So there's massive parallels in their results across the last 2-3 years, you know. And I think there'll be more work done on Slovakia between now and then. Dubravka, their goalkeeper, the Newcastle goalkeeper, is out of the game, which is definitely, you know, good news from an Irish perspective. They have a backup who's at Fulham. And there's another guy who played actually for Slovan Bratislava against Dundalk last year, Dominic Grief, who was excellent in that game. But it doesn't look like he's going to play. But yeah, I mean, their squad, it's funny. You wonder what they say in like... Slovakian news talker. I mean, I'm sure they have a better name for it than that, but Slovakian off the ball. Like, you know what I mean? It probably would be a catchier version of it. Like, I wonder, did they just, do you know the way that in Ireland we tend to like look at, you're about to play Bosnia and it's like, well, look at Dzeko doing this and look at sort of Pjanic doing that. I wonder, like, you know, do they look at it and go, there's Aaron Connolly scoring in the Premier League, there's Conor Harahan scoring at the weekend, there's Callum Robinson scoring twice at the weekend, and that stuff we talked about earlier on, that the Premier League is the most watched league in the world, and there's a lot of Irish players in it at the moment. So I wonder, like, does that shape their perception of how our players are viewed? Yeah. Because you could just as easily imagine that if there was a young Slovakian playing for Brighton, playing the same way as Aaron Connolly,
yeah,
we'd be talking about them going, oh, you know, what's going on here? The one to watch. So do we undersell ourselves at times too? Like that's obviously, sometimes we can overrate our players. That's the perception. But you can look at it both ways. When you look at where opposition players play and you think, actually, Ireland have a lot of players at good clubs.
Well, if you'd said, look, Slovakia have 16 Premier League players, that would make us all sit up a bit straighter, you know. We should be able to put together a very, very decent side with that kind of ammunition. So, you know, broad terms, we touched on selection dilemmas, or certainly the initial dilemma for Stephen Kenny, which is the Coleman-Doherty one. We don't need to rehash that. People can make up their own minds. Based on what we saw, Bulgaria-Finland, we saw an intent to play football, absolutely, with varying degrees of success. And I think that's to be expected. You know, we didn't become fluid and brilliant overnight, but the intent was there. And that's good. worryingly, we saw some defensive lapses we're not quite used to seeing. That's kind of they're the big two takeaways from the first couple of games. But I mean, the big changes to the personnel. So who's definitely in, do we think, and who's, you know, maybe out?
Yeah, I think it's a fair summation of the two games, and I think Stephen Kenny probably believes, and this is to not even read between the lines, it's just interpreting what he said today, really. I was in a separate section, but I think the flavour of the stuff was very similar across everywhere he spoke today. That I think there's a view that when his players are now that his players are match sharp, that it'll be easier for them to operate the system that they adopted last month, and you can see, and I think it was Gary Breen on this show, like, pretty much flagged a concern, like the gaps between Matt Doherty and Shane Duffy, even the goal that Bulgaria scored. You could see James McCarthy was a small bit sluggish as well, and the hope would be that all of those players with much more football under their belts will be able to cover a lot more ground in a more efficient way, because there's no doubt the way that he's asking the team to play, it does involve risks. Like, it does involve, if you're going to encourage a team to press a little bit higher, to play, you know, to operate a high defensive line, that you have to, you know, you have to, your recovery has to be good. Like, you know, like, you look at the best teams in the world. Like, you look at Liverpool last night, and they still give, they play in a particular way, but they give teams chances. But they have this incredible ability to cover because, you know, they're athletic. And I think, like, a Stephen Kenny team playing that way needs to be really energetic and to cover ground. And that's why the mitigating factor you could offer last month was that when players weren't sharp, it was exposed. Mm. And even they looked a bit tired even towards the end of the Finland game. But you did see a conscious attempt to operate a different style. But it's not going to be an easy fit. I think there's no doubt what's going to be interesting is probably the front three. And look, it leans into what you're discussing there about, you know, selection issues that he faces. It was very much a front three in those games, in the sense it was Aaron Connolly and Ida and then O'Dowda. I think if he picks Aaron Connolly on the left side, then that's a statement of intent, because Aaron Connolly isn't naturally someone who'll come back and cover like James McLean does. And he said that himself. He's not, as in Stephen Kenny has said that in the past, that Aaron Connolly's not going to come back and get behind the fullback and make tackles like James McLean will if he's there. But if you then have like a front three with that real attacking responsibility, that the front three are almost strikers, there's a lot of onus on your midfielders, you know, to be real, to be all-rounders that can really get around the park. And that's why where the statement of intent will or will not be, is there a temptation to bring back a McLean or to bring back, say, a right-sided player who's viewed more defensively astute, you know, like a Robbie Brady or someone on that side, like, that it's more of a 4-5-1, I guess, than a 4-3-3. And that's crucial to what happens. You know, I think, as in, that's crucial to the style. And if he sticks with that, then if he sticks with the 4-3-3 style system, like, they just need to be a lot sharper in their application, or else they are going to leave gaps and they will be punished by good sides. But I think they're putting a lot of stock on people physically being able to cover ground better than they could in those games.
And 4-5-1 or 4-3-3, regardless, what's the middle three?
James McCarthy will play, I think. I mean, anytime James McCarthy is mentioned, I think he's enthused. So I think the Robbie Brady's probably, I think, needed to play more football with Burnley. I think. All things being equal, everyone being 100% fit, I think Robbie Brady would probably have a really, really good chance of starting. But I think the fact he's played so little football, it might be hard for him. He'll definitely get on the pitch if he's there. So I think McCarthy's a cert. I would say Hendrick is a cert. And I think it probably comes down to I don't think Malumbi can really go into that game on the strength of one game, and also the fact that he hasn't been playing for Brighton since. So I think it's going to be a decision whether you go with Conor Hourihan, or do you go with Harry Arthur, which is slightly different. But it's, you know, he was, I think he was impressed by Arthur against Finland, and he's got a move to Forest, to Nottingham Forest now, when it looked like he might join Fulham. I sort of think that's going to be the decision. I think he'll play Hendrick. I think he'll play McCarthy. And I think it's going to be Arthur or Hara. Now, do you change the shape of your midfield? Like, is there a temptation to play almost McCarthy and Arthur almost next to each other? Whereas that wasn't the case in Bulgaria. It was McCarthy was very much, you know, the number six. Yeah. And it was at the base, and it was a player either side of him. So it's possible he just goes with that three again. But I think Arthur's the one that's pushing more than anyone to break into the three that played in Bulgaria. That's the way I would look at it.
Yeah. Speaking of McCarthy, actually, and I know he definitely has his critics. Kenny absolutely likes him. I didn't talk to you about this. I was kind of away on holiday, so I wasn't really on around these games. But it jumped out a mile in the Bulgaria game. Remember, Duffy took the ball into midfield in the first minute and lost it, and then attempted to do it on another occasion and lost it as well. And almost Duffy lost his nerve a little bit, and McCarthy was remonstrating with him. You know, several times when Duffy got the ball, McCarthy was almost two-handed gesturing for him. You're meant to carry it into midfield, draw a man and slip it to me. And Duffy, I don't think Duffy liked the look of that. You know, maybe he wasn't feeling his sharpest given where we were in the season, but McCarthy was livid with him and visibly so. And you know, I heard John Giles here on the station subsequent to that saying, well, it's all very well pointing and, you know, and I accept that as well. But things like that, ironing that kind of stuff out, you know, McCarthy clearly had one idea about what Duffy was meant to do. And Duffy maybe knew what he was meant to do and didn't fancy it, or maybe he had a different interpretation. My point is, these are the growing pains as you're trying to put together patterns of play. The notion that we'll somehow be fluid and together for the Slovakia game feels a bit unrealistic, which brings me to the point we could be looking at a James McLean type scenario and more of a 5-1 scenario and just that touch more pragmatism. Not that I think Stephen Kenny has lost the vision that they're hoping to get to, but the importance of this game is such that, you know, it might just have to be a little bit on ice for 90 minutes here, and let's shore things up and let's see where we are.
Yeah, I don't think that even if there may be personnel decisions that lean that way, but I still think that Shane Duffy and James McCarthy will still be in those scenarios where they're expected to play in that way.
Yeah, they will.
It's just that but it's a valid point you make that there's this game and then there's the broader project, for you want of a better term, and there is two other games in this international window. You know, there's games against Wales and Finland where the players that you see as part of the future, they could play in all of those games. You know, they could play in all the Nations League games. But you might do something different for Slovakia because you have to win. But I also think as well that he does think that the best way to win is playing that way. It's just, there's just an individual situations. I did make the point, and I don't even know if I agree with myself on this, but I did look at the last 15 minutes of the Finland game, the way things played out, that he took off Ida and brought on McGoldrick. He took off Connolly and McLean, and then O'Dowda had come off through injury just naturally. Maybe that one, not so much, but Callum Robinson. And the front three at the end was McLean, McGoldrick, Robinson. And I was wondering, is this maybe with that in mind, to see how they get on together? Because McGoldrick could only come in and play. He was only going to play. Now, that could just be coincidental. But I guess what I'm saying is, didn't necessarily need to take a look at James McLean to see what he can offer. He knows what he can offer. And the fact that he brought him on, I wondered, was that with his scenario in mind? And it's possible there may be something in that. But I also think that since then, Aaron Connolly is playing so well.
Yes.
That there's a real just compelling case for having him on the pitch somewhere, somehow.
I agree. I'd love to see him start. You'd love to see Connolly start. And he's shown enough. And I still think, by the way, Duffy will absolutely be encouraged to walk into midfield with the ball, draw a man, and slip to McCarthy. And by the way, John Egan is more equipped to do that. I think Bulgaria sensed maybe Duffy was the man. Let's let Duffy try and do this. And he's going to have to improve that aspect of his game under a Stephen Kenny team. But I guess if Slovakia are good in possession, as Kenny said there and as you've referenced, maybe he does need to think about spells where Ireland are out of possession. And, you know, it's complicated, you know, and these are the conundrums.
It's tough. The thing about Bulgaria was, like, it's a funny one. I know you want to move on, but that... You play Bulgaria and you always assume that they're going to be coming on to you. But he went away from home to play against a team that sat deep. And I think that was a bit disconcerting. You know, whereas Slovakia are going to think dominate the ball a bit more. So maybe the setup would be better suited to playing that type of team. And then you're using Connolly on the break. Whereas there was actually no opportunities to use him on the break in that game because Bulgaria were that deep. That was just one of the curious aspects of it.
Mm. And outside, who's our resident Celtic expert, tells me that Shane Duffy has been carrying the ball a bit out of defence for Celtic of late. So
he's going to get loads of practice with that with Celtic, that's for sure.
No, that's a good point. That's a really good point. It's true. Before you do go, Aviva Stadium, Thursday, 7:30. €3 million game, Dundalk against Classic. I've brushed through the pronunciation there, Dan. Let's leave it at that.
Cal Oi Classic. We just recorded a podcast with a guest from Faroese football expert. So we've got a bit of a Cal Oi Classic.
The Faroes. They're up against the Faroes. Yeah. Talk to me. You've got 2-3 minutes here. Dundalk against the Faroes. This is obviously, stakes couldn't be higher.
It could only be a 2020 story. I mean, this is bizarre, Joe. And by any measure, this is huge. Group stage football is the holy grail for Irish clubs, and I think you can never get blasé about it. 2011 for Rovers, 2016 for Dundalk to get there, were incredible achievements. Really, really, to me, they compare favourably with any Irish sporting achievement of that era.
Yeah.
Purely in terms of appearing, performance relative to scale, resources, etc. But we have this real weird scenario now where Dundalk have this game against the team from the Faroes. You would assume it's the hardest game you would play, whereas through a combination of draws, there was a COVID situation that Faroes meant to play Slovan Bratislava, who had a COVID scare when they arrived in the Faroes. They were quarantined. And look at the draw, a few results, and all of a sudden, here we are in this game. Now, the Faroes, KI beat Dynamo Tbilisi 6-1 last week. They're clearly good. Dundalk, through this is the consolation backdoor route for domestic champions who've been knocked out of the Champions League. Dundalk had a good draw, then a good result in Moldova last week, or Transnistria. But it's just, you look at all the other fixtures on Thursday night, Joe, for playoff for the Europa League. They're all sort of have a underdog, big gun type element to it. And this is just a bizarre tie. It's a massive game. I don't think people may not realise it because there's no glamour aspect to it. But this is as important a game as you'll involve for both teams.
Mm. So Dundalk have a massive opportunity here, a really good chance in this game.
They really do. I mean, they are favourites to win. You would assume the Irish team at this round is the underdog, like Legia Warsaw in the Champions League or whoever. Rovers against Partizan Belgrade, they're the underdog. They're the favourites at home, at home-ish, in the Aviva, closed doors. It's surreal. I spoke to the guy who said, this is the biggest thing that's ever happened football in club football in the Faroe Islands. They can't believe they're playing maybe Dundalk as opposed to, again, Carabag or someone like that. But the Dundalk haven't had a very good year. We've spoken about the ownership before and what's been going on there. They're probably operating off, they're running big losses. And yet, this is an opportunity in one fell swoop to basically much wipe all of that out and sort of take stock again. And I mean, for the players, it's an incredible opportunity personally, but for the club, it's an opportunity to somehow get the show back on the road. We'll talk about it again, but it's a weird game, but it's a massively important one.
Well, we'll be definitely talking about it if they win. We have the Dundalk manager on the show tomorrow night, so obviously we'll be building up to the game with him. Yeah, interesting as
He's
well.
He's had an interesting time. He called it a kamikaze mission coming to Ireland. That was to Ireland, but I don't know what. We're speaking to him tomorrow as well. I'm looking forward to hearing what he makes of it all, because his story is up there with anything that's happened sport-wise in 2020 in Ireland.
Kamikaze averted if they win this. So that's Thursday, 7:30, Aviva Stadium. Dan, I'll be talking to you. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Joe.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power. More confident than United before a Europa League final. Gamble responsibly. See dunluie.net.
Spurs and Chelsea went to penalties, by the way. Eric Dier scored the first. Abrahams equalised. Lamela scored the second. Azpilicueta equalised. Højbjerg scored the third. Jorginho equalised. Lucas Moura scored the fourth. Emerson equalised. Harry Kane, I never know why they put Harry Kane fifth. Harry Kane scored the fifth. Mason Mount missed. Spurs are through. That is 1-0 down to through on penalties. So good evening for Spurs in the Carabao Cup. That's pretty much us done for the evening. Tomorrow's OTBAM will include Keith Wood, Johnny Cooper, Daniel Harris on Manchester United, and Sorka Tiernan as well, Irish basketball international. On tomorrow's show, we will chat to Simon Zeebo, has a European Cup final to look forward to. And Dundalk manager, as I mentioned, will be on the show as well. First time we've really got a chance to speak to him. In the meantime, Tom Dunn on the way. Good luck.
With guilt like your eyes. Ra-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-